I'm involved in a project now to look at the taxpayer costs of family fragmentation. We're going to be releasing the data in July. We got a team of economists. It's a staggering number. We did a careful analysis. We erred on the side of being conservative, completely transparent methodology. So Dave and your friend, your colleagues, maybe you could think about doing that in Canada to use a similar methodology. We could share some ideas, because a lot of folks who maybe don't agree with me about Bonhoeffer and philosophy or theology, if you say, well, my goodness, the costs to the taxpayers of such high rates of divorce and unwed childbearing are very high. And if you could improve the marriage index even a little bit, look at the savings that would accrue to the taxpayers, that can be a useful way to have the conversation that we want to have. Thirdly, I want to say, again, trying to respect your theme today of looking at the economic dimension of things, I think a lot of work needs to be done in how the tax code treats marriage. In the United States, we have a serious problem with marriage penalties that affect particularly low-income people. If a person receiving public benefits gets married in the United States, they're going to get on average a 10 to 30% drop in income just by getting married. So there's a significant marriage penalty. Also, in your country, in Canada, you've moved much further than we have in the U.S., and you're going in a kind of Swedish direction in the sense of taxing everyone as an individual rather than taxing people as a married couple. And so I want to urge you to this needs to be reconsidered. All the evidence we have says that, and if you stop treating married people like they're married, that will weaken marriage. In marriage, what you have is a cooperative union that is not only sexual and emotional, but it's also economic, and so you're sharing resources. And so for then the government to come along and in a fictitious way tax you as if you're not married, among other things, it's an insult to the marriage idea. And if you want to avoid marriage penalties, you permit couples to split their income for purposes of taxation, and there won't be a marriage penalty, and it will be protective of the institution of marriage. So for those of you who are economically minded or in the area of public policy, I really think at least to have a discussion about treating the married couple as a unit at tax time, treating the household as a unit, and permitting couples to split their income for purposes of taxation. And really think hard before you completely accept the notion of taxing everyone as an individual, because it has many harmful effects, including harmful effects on marriage. And it's not because we want to give extra money to married people or to give them special benefits. We just want to recognize the reality of the marriage. It's just recognizing what a marriage is, and you tax it in that way. So that, I think that's an important thing, and I know some of you around the room are doing that. Lastly, I want to say, lastly, I want to say two quick statistics from your neighbor to the south. There's a state where when couples file for divorce, you know, most of our states are no fault in the U.S., more than 40 of the 50 states are pretty solidly no-fault states. We make our marriage law and divorce law at the state level in the U.S., not the federal. But in one of our no-fault states, a friend of mine recently started doing a questionnaire for couples, for people that come in and file for divorce. And the question said, would you or your spouse possibly be interested in a reconciliation? And what proportion do you suppose of people filing for divorce said that at least one of the spouses would be interested in the possibility of reconciliation? It was 25%. which to me was an amazingly high number, because once filing for divorce, you're already way down the road of a crisis in the marriage. So 25% said they were interested. Here's another interesting thing. The people who I'm working with who are working on this, they have this analogy. They said, what would happen if you went into your doctor's office and said, Doc, my arm's really hurting. I'd like you to amputate it today. What would the doctor say? Well, a terrible doctor might just get out the saw and whack it off. But most doctors would say, sorry your arm's hurting. Amputation is definitely an option, but let me just ask you, how are you feeling today? Had any illnesses lately? Are you allergic to anything? What's going on in your life? How's your general health? So what they want to do, these reformers that I'm talking to, I'm admiring in the United States, they want to do that same thing when people file for a divorce. They want to say, yeah, well, we could whack off your marriage right now. That's an option. But how are you feeling today? Would anybody be interested in the possibility of some counseling? And what if 25% said yes? And what if 5% of the 25% actually, not because anybody made them, because they wanted to, entered into a process where they could save their marriage? Well, in the United States and Canada, that would be many hundreds of thousands of divorces that would be would not take place. So this would be, I think, a wonderful experiment to do at the local level to see if couples who are filing for divorce, if some fraction of them, if they were offered the services and the support that they need, not to make them do anything, but you know, in the United States now, I don't know how you do it here, but in the United States when you file for divorce, if you have children, a lot of courts are increasingly saying, well, we're going to make you go to a class to teach you that you can divorce your spouse, but you can't divorce your children, you're supposed to not fight, and you know, how to have a divorce that will have the least harmful effect on your children, which, you know, maybe something could be said for that approach. But what if, in addition to that, or even more importantly, what if we try to do this kind of, you know, let's, maybe you don't want to cut off your arm today approach, and just did an assessment of the couple and see how many couples want to do something different. So what I think is good about that is, you know, we're a little bit swimming against the tide. We don't have to imagine ideas that solve everything at once or that turn everything around completely. What if the divorce rate just went down a little bit? What if through some practical, common sense reforms like that, the divorce rate just dropped a little bit? What if that was good? Lastly, I want to say, if I can take one more minute, that I thought that Doug's presentation was really good in emphasizing the constraining elements of a social institution, and I congratulate him, because that is something that, you know, it's a real insight, and it's a thing that we don't like to talk about too much. That is that kind of sense in which the institution is external to us, and we view it as almost this third party that kind of guides our behavior a little bit. But I want to not to disagree with anything of that, but I want to supplement it with a little bit of a, some thinking that I got from a scholar named Mary Douglas, who wrote a book called How Institutions Think. And she talks in this, she's an anthropologist, and she talks about the social direction of cognition, how our institutions are actually the way we think together, how we share our ideas together about what is good. When we share those ideas together, that's kind of the stuff of which our institutions get created. So it's not always the case that the institution is something different from us and just stands outside us and commands us and directs us against our will. Institutions, when they're working properly, also kind of tap up, they're the way that we as a society express who we really are and who we really want to be. And it's not just eat your peas, it's be the kind of person that you really want to be. We don't always experience the authority of institutions as coercive. Sometimes we experience them as quite natural. And while it is true that marriage is not natural in the way that breathing is natural or eating is natural, it is true that marriage is natural in that it builds upon certain fundamental features of us as human beings. We are pair-bonding creatures. We want to love and be loved. We want that love to last. We want to leave something of ourselves behind. And for many of us, that is in our children. These are deep, natural desires. They are embedded in us biologically and biochemically. Marriage is an imperfect institutional response to those deep factors of our being. That's why marriage is a universal human institution, because it responds to these level one facts of our personhood. So it's not merely a matter of the institution says, don't do this, don't do that, eat your peas. It helps us be this fine thing that we are made for. That's the thing. It's one of the fine things that we are made for as human beings, as to give ourselves to another in as close to a selfless way as possible for us failed creatures. So marriage is this imperfect institution that helps us flawed human beings to try to be the very best that we are capable of in this part of our life that has to do with loving another, and being loved by another, and participating in creation, participating in bringing new life into the world. So it's a very profound thing, and it's the trivialization of it that I and I think many of you probably find so discouraging. It's the shrinking of it, it's the miniaturizing of it that I think could cause us to despair, but ought to cause us to want to act in this time we are given, this little spot of time we have, to act, to try to make something better, try to model something better, to at least speak out for something that's richer and more serious, more related to who we really are as people, and who we want to be as people. And so for that reason, I'm very happy to think of you as kind of brothers and sisters in a common effort, and I'm very happy to be with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, David, for a fascinating talk. We have time for some questions. If people can line up at the microphone. Leah, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for that extremely interesting talk. My question is about the future of marriage. I wonder, what do you see as the future of marriage, basically? Do you think we can stop what's happening today or turn back what's going on? I mean, here in Canada, we already have same-sex marriage, and now we're moving towards a more serious discussion of, you know, multiple parenting, polygamy, and do you think things can actually return to what they used to be, or what do you see as the future of marriage?
I don't think things will return to the way they used to be, because, you know, social change doesn't really work that way. But I do feel that there's a possibility now to have some positive things happen. And I don't feel that we should be lured into a kind of despair or that it's all over, for a couple of reasons. One is that no one knows the future. The future is not some preordained process. The future is a drama. It's an event in freedom. So if you know, in the late, you're young, but in the late 1970s, if people had said, oh, what's the future with respect to communism? People said, oh, communism's here to stay, there's nothing to be done. But then a very few years later, communism was over. So people don't know the future. And people especially don't know the future when it comes to very big questions. People might be able to predict a certain fashion next year and neckties, but on big questions, on first order questions, the future is not known to us. So I think the thing to do is to, that's why this virtue of hope is so important, because Vaclav Havel once said that optimism is believing that things are going to turn out the way you want them to. It's assessing the situation and saying that a good thing's going to happen. That's optimism. And he said, that's not it. Hope says that there are certain things that are worth doing regardless of how things turn out. So this is worth doing regardless of how things turn out for all kinds of reasons. But having said that, I do, with that kind of hope idea, I do think that, for example, in the United States today, there are more African-American children living with their two married parents today than there were 8 years ago. Teen pregnancy way down. Teen sexual activity way down. Teen births way down. Out of wedlock childbearing stopped going up for a while. Unfortunately, last year it ticked up again. It's still much higher than in Canada. Proportion of children living with their own two married parents, it reached a plateau. It hasn't, I don't think it's gone up much in the last 6 or 8 years. Proportion of married couples saying that they're happy has actually increased, marital happiness. The divorce rate is probably modestly declining, even if you take into account the fact that we have more cohabitation in the U.S., although not as much as you have. So there is, you know, the game's not over. The wheels in spin. It depends on what we do. It depends on what we do now. And I don't think that one of the big problems we have, I think, is sometimes we get dejected and even ignore good news. Because we think, oh, it's all bad, and these people don't understand, and the judges and the politics. Well, fair enough, but there's some good things happening, there's good work being done, and with that sense of hopefulness, you have to, without knowing what's going to happen in the future, some things are worth doing.
Great, thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm intrigued by your comment about the study. Is it American Values Institute that's doing the study on family fragmentation and cost to taxpayers? I'd really like to know more about that, because one of the trends, and if families break up, then you have higher welfare, you have higher juvenile delinquency, you have higher incarceration rates as adults, and all those things. How far are you taking the data? How far are you extrapolating? And when's it going to come out, is my first question.
It's going to come out in June, and I'll be happy to share with you about it. It's stunning. It's the first time this has ever been done. Very reputable economists making very conservative assumptions. We'll be able to break it down by state, and we'll be able to break it down by taxpayer. So we'll be able to say the cost of divorce and family fragmentation is this much per taxpayer in certain state. And they've been completely transparent about their methodology. So anybody that wants to say, well, I don't agree with something, will know exactly what they've done. We've set up murder boards of economists who don't agree, and it's passed the test. So I really think it's very solid, and I think the methodology, now there could be some problems with, you know, the way statistics are gathered in the two countries may not be exactly the same, but I would imagine that this methodology that they've used could be helpful to scholars in other countries who want to do this, because as you know, I think particularly for people in the public policy arena, measuring the costs of something can be very valuable. And for all of us, it's just a way to have the big conversation we need to have. You know, maybe for some of you, like, The big thing for me is not what it costs. I mean, that, but I recognize the importance of that to, for communicating to people in the public policy world. So I'd be happy to share this with anybody who wants to possibly. Well, oh, the other thing, you know, about the index, what we're going to do is link it to the index and say, if we could go from this number to a number a little bit lower in the marriage index, this would be the amount of taxpayer savings that might accrue, an estimated amount of taxpayer savings. So it's, so if you improve your marriage index just a little bit, billions of dollars are at stake in terms of taxpayer costs. Because, you know, marriage is a preventive wealth-oriented institution. It stops little problems from becoming big problems, and when marriage isn't there, little problems become big problems, and then the state has to come in with special this and remedial that and more police and so forth. And I think a lot of us have known this at the intuitive, at theoretical level, but this will be the first time that it will be demonstrated at the empirical level that even these tough-minded economists will have to pay a little attention to. Okay.
If there's no further questions, I don't mind putting in a plug for David's book being sold outside. When I read it, it gave me a great sense of optimism. I also learned a lot, and I'm in the business, so it's a good read. David, I'd like to thank you for coming today.